Okay, so for, welcome everyone. So for the people who are on the clock results in comparison to other experiments panel, which is starting now, I see most of you have gotten your computer set up, which is good. Please come up here, and I guess I will begin by allowing all of you to introduce yourselves. This is the microphone for the panel. This is the one for the speaker. Just give us the 30-second introduction to who you are and where you're from and your primary interests.
I'm John Rule from Case Western, and I work on CMB cosmology experiments, including a Southpole telescope and a Spider, which is an R machine that we're going to fly this December.
Hello, I'm Grace Roche. I'm JPL Caltech. I'm a Planck scientist and member of a core team, and today I'll be talking a bit about Planck, of course.
Hans Christian Eriksen. I'm at University of Oslo, working on Planck, CMB analysis, and Bayesian analysis in general.
I'm Dmitry Pogosin from University of Alberta, Canada. My interests are theoretical cosmology, but here I'm as a Planck associate working on some parts.
I am Andrew Jaffe from Imperial. I'm also a Planck scientist and do lots of other things, but I'll be talking about Planck here too.
I'm Chris Sigurdsson from UBC, and I'm the token non-Planck scientist. Okay. I do cosmology and connections to particle physics.
Okay, thanks. I'm Chris Harada. I'll be moderating, and I'm also a non-Planck cosmology person, one of the few. So the format today is I will give an extremely brief introduction, and then allow each of our panelists to talk for approximately 5 minutes about some aspect of the Planck results, and some will be coordinating their presentations, and then we will at the end of that open this up to audience participation. This is really intended to get a discussion going. That's what the slides here are for. They're not supposed to be just an extension of the talks. Please do feel free to ask questions and be controversial if you like. If you'd like to show something as part of your questions, as long as it's brief, yes. Or if there's a particular plot you'd like to show for discussion, please do keep that brief and keep the questions coming. Are there any other questions before we begin? Okay, so hopefully there will be some after we end. Before I hand this over to my Planck colleagues and a couple of non-Planck colleagues to talk about what they're doing with the data set, I thought I would say a little bit about what impressed me about it. So this was the first observational result I ever showed at a scientific conference. As you can see, it's about 9 years old now, and it was the cross-correlation of lensing of the microwave background with a galaxy survey. I think there are a couple of things to note about this plot. One is that it, of course, consumed many nights with no sleep to get it done, which is I guess how cosmology has traditionally been done. But more importantly, you should see that with the greatest data sets of the time, Sloan and WMAP, the lensing signal was, as you can see, one sigma. So this was a non-detection. The data points are all over the place. Here we are 9 years later, and this I pulled out of one of the Planck papers. Wow, there's a 10 sigma detection, it happens to basically lie on the theory curve, but a factor of 10 in sigma, we're not cheating by quoting the variance there, that sigma. I think that represents real progress, and I think this is just one example of how amazing the Planck data are, I hope there is more to come. But before the next Planck data release, I will conclude and hand this over to the panel. Anyone can be first.
Is there anyone who's burning to be first?
Okay, I guess you're first.
Sure. So I agree with Chris that the Planck data is amazing. And as a member of the SPT collaboration, I think we were first struck by how great that agreement was. But if you read the appendices in the Planck papers, you'll know that there's talk of a little bit of tensions. So I want to talk about those tensions and what we've learned about them since the Planck data came out. First of all, the big change in Planck relative to the previous WMAP plus SPT cosmology was in the matter density, which then drives H as well. And at some level, I don't care what the matter density is exactly, unless there's something interesting there. And the something interesting now in the Planck results is that there is some tension with, of course, the Riess and Friedman measurements of H naught, and then also there's a tension in there with regards to sigma 8 and cluster counts. So you can chalk those up to astrophysics, or you could search for model extensions that'll bring those things into more agreement, or maybe something else. But I think it's it behooves us to look at the data and ask what's been shifted around and try to see if we can learn anything, see if there's any disagreement in the power spectrum bands and that kind of thing. So first, before I get to the direct power spectrum comparisons, these are some plots made by Zhen Ho at UC Davis. The first one on the left came out of his paper, which was with the last SPT release. And this illustrates the tension between that existed at that time between the H naught and the baryon measure of the baryon statistic on baryon acoustic oscillation statistic on the y-axis. And that's shown for the BOSS BAO, and then in particular for the Riess et al. H naught, because the Friedman one came out kind of late in our work on that paper. And what's shown there is then the dots are from the CMB chain, where that falls in this space for our lambda CDM model, color coded by matter density. And what you can see is that we were kind of on top of the range for H naught, but in some tension with BAO. And what's happened with Planck on the right is that's moved along that same degeneracy line and is just naturally towards higher omega matter, but is now in agreement with the BAO, but then in tension with H naught. So this is a nice space to sort of see that in. Now, looking at the actual power spectrum, this is no data, just the best model fits. Here, what you can see in the top plot is, and this is straight out of the Planck papers. Is that there's a little bit of disagreement over the first couple peaks in terms of the amplitude of the power spectrum, but actually for those best fit models, after an L of about 600 or 700, the agreement is quite stunning in the model space, right? And I just want to note that the SPT really only measures down to L of 650, and then WMAP measures the spectrum below that. So now. Now, we did calibrate off of WMAP, but only to a 2.6% uncertainty. And of course, you can ask about that calibration floating with respect to when we have Planck now. And what we've seen is that we don't need to change the calibration very much to be in great agreement with Planck. So now let's talk about how, of course, these peak height differences drive matter density. So let's look at some of the evolution. They're not evolution, but the various data sets, what you get with in terms of matter density here. So there's no ordering here except for I made them fall, okay, as you should go across the plot. So the Planck matter density is here, WMAP plus SBT over here, and you can ask why is that different? Well, if we switch to WMAP9, you actually make up about a good fraction of the difference here. And there's some other hints that about what's going on if you either discard 217 gigahertz or if you limit the band powers in Planck. There's some shifts in matter density, so there's some hints there. But this is not a big tension, especially when we use WMF9, right? That's the first thing to say. Looking at the band powers themselves, this is another plot right out of the Planck paper. And what you can see here is that, first of all, in the residuals here with pink Planck and blue SBT, is that there's marvelous agreement of SBT with respect to the Planck model, which is down the bottom of the red line. There's some argument in the paper that there's a little bit of excess here, but the delta chi-squared between the two models, the WMAP plus SBT model and Planck plus SBT over the SBT region is really small. So we're really happy with the agreement. And then we did take the Planck 143 gigahertz map, cut out the SPT section, and then filtered it with our scan strategy, so we're looking at the same modes. And there, after you recalibrate by 1.8%, the agreement is stunning. Okay, the dashed line is the Planck beam uncertainty. That's filtered by delta L of 500, by the way, so there's really, that's been smoothed quite a bit, that curve. And then finally, at 143 gigahertz, we've looked at the Planck all-sky 143 gigahertz power spectrum, corrected for the difference in the Poisson sources, and then looked at that relative to SBT, so SBT minus Planck over SBT. And there's no evidence for a tilt or anything like that once there's a 1.8% correction in the calibration. So, to step back a second, I think what we're seeing is that the band powers themselves agree both with Planck on our particular patch of sky to really great accuracy, and that at 143 gigahertz, the all-sky Planck power spectrum agrees with our power spectrum really wonderfully. Other things to note, this is highlighting omega matter I've been getting at, and then the band powers. There's NS came up this morning, and somebody actually said something about, are we sure, maybe Planck got NS wrong or something in an offhand comment. I just want to point out that there's really good consistency in the rest of the cosmological parameters for pre-Planck versus Planck. The significance has grown, but the values have not shifted. That's true with some of the extensions as well. One thing that I think there's been a little bit of a misunderstanding about is that SBT did publish this paper just before Planck came out that highlighted this particular number at some level, where we combined BAO and H-naught with the CMB, and it looked like NF was running a little high. Okay, but if you see if you compare these numbers, when you use the same data sets, there's actually very little difference between the Planck results and the SBT plus WMAP results. So finally, in case I'm reaching my 5 minutes, these are, what I think the big picture is that the 143 gigahertz map agrees extremely well with SBT and vice versa. That's, as it says here, not exactly the same thing as does the full Planck CMB likelihood itself, agree with that. But to the extent that 143 gigahertz is consistent with within Planck itself, then that gives you the answer. And the model is certainly consistent with our band powers. Changing from WMAP 7 to WMAP 9 reduces some of the matter tension that we saw. And there's some hints, if you want to worry about the extra sigma or sigma and a half that's left, then there's various hints about where it might be coming from. But, it's not clear that we'll ever really understand that until we have more data. And luckily, of course, there is more data coming that'll inform this.
So here I'm going to focus mostly on the Planck data and trying to take a comparison of level power spectrum and the parameters with other experiments. So first of all, I'm looking at Planck versus Planck. And within the collaboration, we did estimate power spectra using different approaches and actually using, in some sense, different maps. So for instance, in this particular plot here, I don't have to, you can see in blue the power spectrum derived from a cross spectra, the three frequencies, 143 to 17 gigahertz. In red, you see the power spectrum estimated from a CMB map after component separation. And at low L, of course, in both cases, we have power spectrum estimated commander, mostly as well a component-separated process and using Gibbs sampling. But looking at this, what I want to take out, take off from this plot, is the absolute agreement of the power spectra within, you know, within Planck. And this, I'm saying, is using, in some sense, different maps because I process differently using different masks and different techniques, different algorithms to actually estimate this spectrum. Now, but we didn't just see that. This is an example. You can see that in one of Planck papers where you see the distribution of the cosmological parameters, the reference model, for different validation tests we did. There are many here, I'm not going through them, of course, but that's just to show you the level of consistency of our internal validation tests of our own data. Now, here I'm just giving a bit more of a detail so that you understand what we are doing here. When we use the component-separated maps, we used a foreground modeling that actually is not tailored for the particular CMB map. So it's, in fact, an approximate methodology. And this, we need, in fact, more sophisticated foreground modeling in order to tackle larger values of the multiples and smaller angle scales. Nonetheless, and in spite of that, this is sort of agreement we get. And on the top plot, what I want to show you here is the angular power spectrum subtracted, the best fitting foreground model has been subtracted from data points compared to the black solid line, which is the best fit model from the multi-frequency run, okay, from the cross spectra of the three frequency maps. In the middle panel, you see the residual of the data points to that best fit model, and in the bottom, you see residuals of the best fit models for the different maps using different component-separated maps, okay? In yellow, we have the SMICA map. It has been used as a reference, CMB map. You can see it looks really pretty good when you look at the residuals of the best fit models. On the right-hand side, you have the parameters as estimated. All of this is done for LMAX of 2000, and you can see that all is very much in agreement within one sigma. And this is, as I say, using a very not a particularly sophisticated foreground modeling, and already you are getting quite very good results, and they are consistent with each other. Now, this is just a collection of all several experiments here, because now I'm going to move to a comparison with WMAP. So usually you see this table, and the only thing I wanted to show is that, yes, it's good to give it in terms of WMAP sigma. Let's do it in terms of the Planck sigmas. So the significance, of course, increases. But mostly thing I want you to discuss here is that one thing is to look at independent parameters, but the variation in the parameter is not independent. And in fact, they talk together to the spectrum. So the net effect is actually much more significant than that. Okay? So for instance, here I'm just showing the same spectra I was in previous slide, and overplot the WMAP in brown, WMAP man in brown. And then you have the best fit model here in brown. And you can see these deviations in very high L, for instance, to start with. This plot is logging just to show that. But now, let's go back and let's look at first peak and around first peak and more and beyond that. And what this plotting is showing here, and this is a courtesy of Chris Gorski, you see that in purple you have the ratio of V to W, W map. In blue is the ratio of 70-100 gigahertz from Planck. Looks very much in agreement, in particular if you look at LMAX of 400. But then if you look at the ratios of 70 and V, 100 and W, 17 V is yellow, and 100 W is red. You see, in fact, this sort of shift in power. So in fact, WMAP has more power than Planck by 2.5%. But I should also say is that this is not just a calibration factor. There is, in fact, is modulated, is a function of L, so it has a shape dependency as well, okay? And I think I'm going, I have a few more slides, but I have 5 minutes, so I'm going to stop here. And now I'm going, as Kristin is going to continue to discuss the statistical significance of these sort of discrepancies.
Okay, thank you. So my slides are more or less a comment to the discussion yesterday about Planck versus WMAP, 2.5%, and so on. And make that into a comment about the difference between precision, accuracy, and robustness, and how that sort of sets the stage for Planck. So just to remind you, oops. So just to remind you what the difference between precision and accuracy is that, well, precision means essentially just small error bars, while accuracy means actually having the right solution. So you can have a low precision, low accuracy, not very good experiment, or you can have a high precision but low accuracy experiment, which has clustered, or you can have wide scatter but on the right answer, or you can, what you hope to have is high precision and high accuracy. I thought it was interesting to have a look at a statement on that has been added to Lambda very recently, comparing, so this is the same table as Gauss showed, comparing WMAP and Planck in terms of parameters, which says the new Planck results strongly favor the standard 6-parameter Lambda CDNOME model with the parameter values that are consistent with WMAP parameters as shown in this table. So if you actually look at the spectra, you can see that they are quite different, actually. So even if you look at marginalized parameters, in terms of marginal parameters, if you compare that to maximum likelihood point, the models, and for me, parameters are not the model, the CLs is more the model. This is what you see as the difference between them. This is the ratio between the two. And so here is the like 2.5% that we have been talking about, and then the discussion is this a constant or not? That's an ongoing discussion. It has wiggles at the, like 2% on top of this thing here. We can discuss that in other places. What I was wondering about, how significant is this really? And what I wanted to do was, what I tried to do was simply fit the amplitude of this spectrum to the WMAP likelihood. So take the WMAP likelihood, insert the Planck spectrum and multiply it with a factor just to see what you get. And this is the result. So here is 2.4%, and you can see there is 1. So that means that the Planck spectrum is more or less ruled out by WMAP at 5.5 sigma because of this offset. Additional structure if you think about that. You can see the same thing if you look at the provided Monte Carlo chain samples that are generated for the standard 6-parameter model by WMAP. Here is the negative log likelihood from the Monte Carlo chain. And if you just plug in the Planck best fit spectrum, that is the corresponding negative log likelihood of chi-squared, if you want. And you can see one sample out of those 1.3 million happens to have a higher chi-squared. So again, that's roughly 5 sigma. So what we are looking at here is first of all, at COBE, I think everybody agrees that had low precision, but did pretty well. The question then is, where is Planck and WMAP in these two? That is not clear yet. So we need to figure this out because we now I think this is one of the impressive things about both WMAP and Planck now. We're talking about a 2.5% difference, and yet we can rule each other out by 5 sigma. So that says something about how powerful these experiments really are. And we can really go to the bottom of these issues and figure out even small problems, or small problems like 2.5%. So I definitely think we have been in the age of precision cosmology for a long time. But are we in the age of accurate precision cosmology yet? I think, given that the error bars seem to be quite large off, we haven't reached that stable yet, reached that level yet. And I think that Planck now, with two independent strong data sets, we actually are able to go into that stage where we have both accuracy, both of them are very accurate. We can now make those data agree through a common understanding of both data sets. And that also makes us robust, because now we have demonstrably shown that both of them can reach the same level once we sort out that minor issue. So to me, this shows the importance and power of both WMAP and Planck, and it lets cosmology take one step further in terms of now showing that we understand what's going on, and the systematic effects are clearly subdominant. So, to me, these 2.5% is a really good showcase on what you can do with these data sets. So, I think it's going to be interesting to see what happens, but I think it's a good suggestion.
Okay. So this morning, Andre reminded us that if you're going to create something from nothing, it's probably going to be compact. So we should look for it. So just a reminder, so if the universe has an interesting topology, say that of the torus, as was offered to us this morning, then the fundamental domain is a cube. So in this, these are three tilings of the universe that could apply, with the last scattering surface being the same size and then changing the size of the fundamental domain with respect to it. And in this case, the two spheres that are the same but next to one another just kiss. So there's really no repeated circles. In this case, they intersect at the edges, and in this case, they intersect at the corners, and so they're getting smaller and smaller. Or the fundamental domain is getting smaller and smaller. And it becomes easier and easier to see as you move to there, as you get more repeated structure. So another way to put that is when the scale of the topology is less than the horizon scale, which is approximately the last scattering surface, then you can see it. And one thing that does, of course, is it suppresses power on large scales, but in particular, what you want to do is not just look for the suppressed power, because that's a very blunt instrument, and it can lead you to finding soccer balls when they're not there. You want to find the detailed correlations. So the historical way that people developed to do this originally, was actually to look in galaxy surveys, but then in the CMB, just to directly look for those matched circles at antipodal directions on the sky and to see if you see them. But the more detailed and powerful method, if you can do it, is to explicitly calculate the likelihood, which is not hard to do, but is a more calculationally intensive task. You start out with a 3D Gaussian random field with usually a more or less inflationary starting condition, and then you just do the geometry. And so it's more or less the same calculation that you have to do in the simply connected case. You just have to keep track of more things. So when we do that, so the circles in the sky, so this is just sort of Bond-inspired transparency, which only is about half the information density of one of Dick's, because that's just all I could do. But so this is the circles in the sky statistic, and a 1% detection threshold is that dashed line up there. Is there a thing that I can point with other than
there's
my fingers?
There's a big stick over here.
Big stick. A small stick with a red light. Good. Yeah. I'll try. Don't say anything mean. So this is Planck doing circles in the sky. This is as a function of the opening angle of the circle, or the opening radius, I guess, for different component separation methods. And this is our detection threshold, so we can rule it out at one, you know, at 99%. And then this is the likelihood calculation, which Dimitri will talk a little bit more about next. Basically, the likelihood ratio for large to small universes, because we're astronomers, so things go backwards. So, and as you can see, basically the likelihood peaks outside the horizon, although there are some interesting features, which I think Dimitri will talk about a bit more. This is the cubic torus, basically the picture you saw before, and this is for the dodecahedron, the soccer ball that isn't actually the soccer ball. And you know, you see there are some weird, potentially weird local and in fact absolute maxima in places like that, which we actually do end up seeing in simply connected models that we run through as a simulation. So we know, or we don't have any evidence that this is real evidence, sadly, for interesting topology. And this is just pictures of what the correlation structure looks like in the correlations here, and then in the various realizations thereof for the dodecahedron, an octahedron, and the cubic torus. And as you can see, these are basically rows of the correlation matrix. And whereas in the simply connected case, of course, this is just C of theta, in other cases, you get all this interesting and fun, rich structure here. And then we can make realizations. And of course, it's important to note that, you know, it's not that easy to see what's going on in the realizations. So that's why you really need to keep all this structure there. As a brief aside, probably should have just done this in the other order, but because this is all from the same original Planck paper, I'll remind everybody that in the same spirit of looking for the background cosmological model, we also consider the Bianchi 7H model, which has global shear and rotation, which are linked to one another, and which also therefore determine in principle omega. And we do this in the full setting with both omega matter and omega lambda, as was calculated over the last decade or so. And so you can induce interesting patterns depending on the values of these things, which there's one that fits very well, has a cold spot, has some swathes in here which seem to match some patterns in the sky. But sadly, if you actually see what omega is for this, it's very, very different from the one that seems to apply in the universe. You'll see in a minute. And of course, if you're ESA, then you say, this is beautiful. I lost the terrible ESA PR picture, in which they add this to this, which of course is not what we would have predicted even if this were right. You don't add them, this is already there. And it sort of highlights the swathes and the cold spot. But it does predict this. This has been known since 2005, 2006. when our ESA scientist asks for a picture, we give it to him. not terribly well reproduced, my apologies. So this is the case when we decouple the cosmological parameters from Bianchi parameters. And sadly, I can't even tell what these are, but sort of omega baryons of 0.4, things like that. So, you know, these are just not right. If we couple, so and these are the likelihoods for those, and it's, you know, if you, it's relatively well picked out. If you couple the parameters, as you should, so this is, you know, physics and this isn't, then you get bad parameters, and crucially, you're really dependent on even the details of the component separation, because you're sort of, you want to see patterns, you want to put them into the unobserved parts of the sky. So it's really just a bad fit to the data. If you do keep the cosmology flat and you ask what is the vorticity in this case, then it's constrained to 1 part in 10^9 or so. Okay, so that's the end of my bit of the presentation. Then Dmitry will move on to going back to the topology.
Right, as you understand, so one Dix-like slide is maybe contains 5 talks. So what I'm actually doing, I'm decomposing one slide into separate slides. And can you go back? I actually have to say a little bit more about likelihood analysis of the compact topologies in Planck. And so we're interested to find out whether really the space of our universe is styled by repeating pattern of some strange styles like the dodecahedron, for example, for a closed universe, or a toroidal one. So that's actually possible topological shapes of fundamental domains which can style the universe. What topology introduces? It introduces large angle correlation between regions of the sky, and in particular regions in the temperature maps. And you want to search for these regions. It is, in some sense, large angle phenomena. So we are can limit our analysis for a low resolution and site 16 map. So that's the SMICA
Planck map with a mask which leaves 78% of the sky, and it covers angular scales up to L something like 40 or something. So it is a low-res large angle phenomenon that we're speaking about. So what, there's too many buttons, I'm pressing on the microphone. what I would actually like to stress is that Planck by itself does not really tell you strictly that the universe is flat. It does allow for some curvature, even including Lenzing signal. So without Lenzing signal, there is a long life of degeneracy. With the Lenzing signal, there is a still some possibility for the, first of all, closed universe, and even a little bit of the open universe on this side. And with, from the point of view of topology, that has fundamental difference. So possible multi-connected universes in a flat space and in a curved space are totally different. And therefore, there is actually a lot of difference between omega k minus 0.01 and omega k equals 0. And yes, if you add Bau, so 0.01 becomes less favorable, but still, so we should not yet think that we really nailed the statement that the universe is strictly flat. Omega k minus 0.01 is actually a pretty large value. It means that we already observed 1/100th of the whole volume of a sphere. Quite a large fraction of a sphere. And if you're dealing with a compact space, that actually becomes a space of the size of you can observe. Really, for a favorite dodecahedron model, or famous dodecahedron model, at omega k equal minus 0.001, that's approximately when the size of the dodecahedron is equal to the size of the scattering circle. The signals that we see, if our space is much larger than when we see, we're supposed to see a correlation. It is just a map of the correlation with the north pole, with the rest of the pixels, and has nothing but a little bit of an obvious dipole, smooth isotropic function. If you decrease the size of the space, as you start approaching the size of the domain, the size of the domain approaches the size of the last scattering surface, you see some enhanced correlation at a large angle of separation. The way to think about it is to actually think about all possible images of the North Pole, for example, in space. And that is the map which is below. I'm sitting at an observer at the center, and I'm looking at all images. This is a closed universe of the North Pole, which populate the whole space at different distances. And I need to make a cut with the last scattering surface through this field of images. And at this particular value, it is exactly those two closest images to us that starts to be noticeable. It approaches large scattering surface, it has this correlation. As I go further to a smaller and smaller space, that is actually just selection of, I'm just now selecting of images which practically lie on the last scattering surface. And so that's the ones which produce the most of the pattern. Increasing the weight how far I see or decreasing the space of the universe, I start capturing more and more images by my cut with less scattering surface, and I have a very complicated patterns if my space is small. I did something like 10% of the distance to last scattering surface, plus minus 10%. So it's a shell. In reality, that can be and is lies behind numerical computation with the method of images, which one of the techniques that we use to compute the correlation function between pairs of pixels. So that's why I'm using it for an illustration purposes here. There is an integrated effect through the space due to Sachs-Wolfe effect, but actually for lambda models with Planck parameters, it's not very large. It actually smears a little bit of patterns, but patterns are mostly dominated by the surface structure. If you go to open spaces, integrated maps look quite different from the surface ones. And here is the likelihood. So that's actually our attempt to detect a topology in a simulated map which has a topology. And there are two models. Both of them are dodecahedra, but of a different size. One of them of a size that you just exactly inscribe last scattering surface into the domain. And if you have it, you indeed measure it on a map that is drawn from this theory, you do have quite a notable white peak right here. So that's a blue line which has quite a notable detection at exactly where you are. If you have a smaller space, which is, for example, a black line, the detection is even stronger. There is actually interesting thing that you tend to detect something for any topology that you have, which is a little bit above the size of the scattering surface, not exactly where the fiducial isotropic flat model lies. So that's an interesting phenomena, but it is practically the same in all topologies, and it is the same even if applied to an isotropic map. Right? I'm coming with a compact theory, CTPP prime from a compact theory applied to a realization of an isotropic map, and that is a red line, and I see this a little bit bumped by delta log L around maybe reaching 5.7. So if I do it for different models, so here are the features. So main story is that likelihood starts dropping when the universe is small. It essentially starts dropping a little bit for the spaces that are somewhat smaller than a fundamental domain. If you just inscribe last scattering surface in the domain, it's just the beginning of interesting features, it drops down. Drop is not monotonic. Indeed, when you go to the next layer of images, there is a change which is not necessarily monotonic. Maybe something hit a local maxima, but it is consistent. And it's consistent between all the maps, and you always have a little bit of excitement of a likelihood at large spaces. But again, the red line is an example of an application of a kind of null test to a perfectly isotropic map, and it shows what can have what you can see in a perfectly isotropic map. So formally the limits are for the models that we worked through. Bunch of them are topological, flat, toroidal ones. Some of them are curved with a positive curvature. There are a couple of examples with a negative curvature. But main outcome is that you really don't see a topology with a scale, and the scale is approximately an inscription kind of scale, large scale, large scale scattering sphere, just a little bit sticking out of the fundamental domain. So that is if your spaces are more or less equal-sided, rounded, but a couple of spaces had very high symmetry, and they're restricted a bit less. So for example, if it is just a slab, only one dimension is dimensions are infinite, and it is flat space, limits are weaker. So I'll stop here, sorry.
Great, so I'm gonna talk about some interesting physics I've been thinking about recently that can be constrained with high L data, including Planck. Okay, this is actually, I want to advertise work that has been done in conjunction with my former grad student, Enrico Fermi. Francis Siracine, who's now a postdoc at JPL. So we know in the standard model, neutrinos interact through weak interactions, which have a very small coupling strength of around 10 to the minus 11 MeV to the minus 2. And this means that neutrinos decouple close to a temperature of 1.5 MeV. That's the place where the visibility function of neutrinos peaks if you calculate it. And this means that very early on in the history of the universe, neutrinos start to free stream. And due to this free streaming, they exert shear stress on photon perturbations, as was elucidated very nicely by Basinski and Seljak in 2004. And the two main effects are that you damp the amplitude of photon fluctuations and you introduce a phase shift in the photon fluctuations in K or L space that depends on the fraction of relativistic energy in the universe that's free streaming. So in the standard canonical model, this is 0.403 if you have three neutrinos free streaming and the photon temperature that we know about. And as you increase the number of neutrinos that are not free streaming, you see this phase shift and amplitude suppression go away. And this was used, for instance, by Trotta and Melchiori to give evidence for having free streaming neutrinos in cosmology using the C viscosity parameterization. So the question here is, what can the new data, the new cosmological data, tell us about neutrino self-interactions? And we're taking a slightly different take on this. So rather than parameterizing it by a phenomenal viscosity parameter, we want to say that there's some unknown new interactions, and let's just parameterize it as some effective four-fermion interaction that has a strength bigger than G Fermi. So if you do that, not surprisingly, what happens is you are able to shift the peak of the neutrino visibility function down to lower redshift. So this is a plot as a function of this some G effective that comes into the effective thermal cross sections for neutrino self-scattering. And this introduces an effective neutrino opacity that modifies the Boltzmann hierarchy. And so if you go in detail into something like CAM and modify the equations to include these extra opacity terms, they tend to damp out the higher moments of the neutrino hierarchy and modify the CMB. The physics is you're delaying the neutrino free streaming. So this is a plot of two cases. So this is the standard model neutrinos, which you know, if you start off with an overdensity in space, will just fly away at the speed of light, and that's given by this red curve. This blue curve is if you have self-interacting neutrinos early on, and instead they travel more coherently and travel at the speed of sound. The impact on the photons, you can see here, is that you get a suppression of the amplitude. And the gravity from these extra neutrinos being out here pulls the photons ahead a little bit, giving you this shift in the photon sound horizon. Okay, so this is a plot of the temperature power spectrum for different values of this effective constant, and you can see that as you go from having the constant be 10 to the minus 2 MeV to the minus 2 down to 10 to the minus 4 MeV to the minus 2, you recover a power spectrum that looks like the standard lambda CDM model. So you wouldn't be surprised if I show you constraints on this effective parameter or in terms of what our chains look like. Okay, we find that you have lots of samples at G effective less than 10 to the minus 4, which just means that these models are consistent with a lambda CDM CMB power spectrum. But what I was surprised was that when we extend the neutrino interactions to larger values, we find this alternative island of interacting neutrinos at lower values of the spectral index and some particular value of this interaction self-interaction constant. Okay, and this is actually driven by a physical degeneracy. So this is the best fit lambda CDM model, including Planck data. And this is in this alternative mode. And what you can do is you can change the amplitude and spectral index of the primordial power spectrum and introduce this effective neutrino interaction of the right strength. And that allows you to both fit high L and low L data. And as you can see, it's a very near degeneracy. So if you overplot, the data, you can see these are equally good fits, and the delta chi squared between them is negligible. Okay, so this is just a provocative thing to show you that maybe we don't know everything we think we know about primordial cosmology. Obviously, there's assumptions going in here, and this interacting neutrino island cosmology is actually quite reasonable in terms of all the other cosmological parameters consistent with cosmological data, but you have to introduce this extra physics in the neutrino sector, and that's compensated by a different set of primordial parameters. So I'll leave it there.
All right. Yes. Let's go to questions. I guess Matthias. I guess we have our first question. Go ahead.
So this is like semi question, more like comment. If this is really just a degeneracy, then you would expect to get a lips or banana, but you really get a separate island if I understood that plot correctly, right? Which means that something happens in between. So there are models with high GFX
yes.
that work, they stop working and they start working again.
Exactly.
So it might be something more complicated than
simple degeneracy. Well, this is all very, very new. So this paper will be coming out in 3 days or something. So, but as far as my current understanding is that you have so you have an L-dependent phase shift and amplitude suppression, which you can pick one point to fix that at, and so you can try to fit the first peak, but if you go to higher values of G effective, then you basically have the same phase shift and amplitude suppression everywhere, and so you, at this one point you can choose as a pivot point, and then by taking the different amplitude in NS you can fit the rest of the peaks.
How do you do with a standard model? I mean, the neutrinos belong to a doublet, so if you make it interacting.
Well,
how do you prevent the electrons being interacting?
If it's only through sort of Majorana-like couplings.
No, but that means you want to break, if you have electrons and neutrinos interacting differently, you need to involve the Higgs doublet. The Higgs doublet is the only thing that by its expectation value breaks SU2. But this, you need then non-renormalizable interactions, and I'm not sure if you would not have seen them.
Because I'm putting this out there
as the
just,
electron
just
interactions, we know them.
It's a
well.
Provocative thing to think about, you know, what we know about cosmology and assumptions and going into what our cosmological parameters are. But this, so you can write down models that are perfectly consistent with the standard model that have these kind of interactions with scalars, for instance.
Okay, I guess we have one up here.
So this is to John. So it was neat to see the blocks showing the SPT data, but I still have an outstanding question in my head that I don't think I've seen resolved yet, I think, which is that, you know, there's this, before Christmas, you guys put out a paper saying that there's evidence that you know, a little more than 2 sigma that you need new physics, the new SPT data combined with WMAP. And now we're saying, actually, SPT is completely consistent with Planck. And Planck doesn't want new physics. So I think there's something a bit weird here, right? Because you're using WMAP to combine with SPT. We think that WMAP and Planck actually look rather consistent at L less than 1,000, except for an overall shift. And one allows the SPT calibration to float, so that should be actually absorbed in that floating of the relative calibrations. So I think I'm still wondering, why is there this excess damping seen in SPT if the spectra actually agrees so well with Planck?
Yeah, I'm not sure that the damping is the right description because we don't see across SPT a slope with respect to Planck. And in fact, all along, what we thought was driving the running, for example, is a difference in the tilt in WMAP versus SPT. That could be related to something going on with, you know, you guys not seeing just a DC shift of WMAP versus there being a shape to it. I don't know. But then another thing is that if you take Planck L less than roughly 1,000 and combine it with SPT, some of these things shift too. So it's not true that Planck is completely the same when combined with SPT as WMAP is. So I suspect that these things are going to go away when we combine with, say, you know, Planck less than 1,000, that kind of thing. So I don't claim to understand it fully yet. I think we have to work on it. And I share your sense that hey, what's happened, right? But at least we're seeing half of the problems in most cases disappear.
I actually have a related question, John. So you said that when you combine with WMAP 9 rather than WMAP 7, the problem was mitigated.
With matter, yeah.
Yeah, so, sorry. But there isn't that much difference between WMAP 7 and WMAP 9, so why has
Well, actually, if you look at the WMAP value of omega matter, it actually shifted. And another thing you should take away from that plot that I put up is that SPT does not actually torque around the WMAP values of omega matter H squared very much at all. It shifts them a little bit away in the direction, you know, to away from the direction that Planck is, and it tightens the error bars by a little bit, but not very much. So we're not pushing around in the omega matter parameters WMAP very much at all.
Thank you very much for showing us the comparisons of the Planck data internally. It's quite hard for outsiders to understand and interpret that because, of course, for many of those comparisons, you're looking at the very same sky through, in many cases, the very same instrument end-to-end, which is a very different consistency check than others. But my question is, one of the things that many people have been thinking about and discussing are the very low-level problems that are being addressed in the Planck analysis. For example, the ADC nonlinearity, which is kind of addressed in a different basis from which the problem exists, and the deglitching. At what level are comparisons being done where you use actually different methods of addressing those issues? What consistency checks are there that will give us more confidence in that?
Well, actually, we did several consistency checks. You know, we tried to tackle the ADC nonlinearity, as you were saying, the glitching as well. We realized, for instance, that we had, just an example, we had a correlation at high L in the noise, in particular for the HFI frequency, HFI instrument, and it turned out in the end that this was actually related with the glitching process we were using. And of course, that creates some problems, because when we do your analysis, sometimes you assume that noise is white noise at high L, and then you start seeing that there are some these correlations, and then you try to figure out why are there here, okay? On the other hand, because of course, if you start having correlated noise, then you have to be a bit cautious in your data analysis. And in particular, if you start using simulations in order to, for instance, noise debias your power spectrum estimation, then you have to be very cautious because simulations might not reflect what you are seeing in your data. So actually, that took a bit of time to understand until we understood it. And as soon as we knew the source of this problem, then we can tackle it properly. So this is, I think, we try and we did in some cases actually sort of problem. Some of them were working on it still. With regards to internal consistency, I just want to make a point, a comment on what you just said. It's the same instrument, but actually we have two different instruments in one instrument. And actually, exactly, and one of the things that for me is fascinating is to see, say, 70 gigahertz or 9 gigahertz and see the consistency level. And that's why I show that plot where you compare these to each other and then to the VNW channels of WMAP, and they do differ. So I think that's just two different instruments. No, one is radiometer, the other bolometers, you know, totally different systematics, subject to different sort of problems, and we still get quite a high level of consistency. So that makes you wonder, makes you think. I think we need really to tackle this problem. Okay. Well, I mean, this inconsistency with the WMAP. I don't know if you want any other question. Yeah, sure.
I'm not sure if that's what you asked about Grassa's plots, but her first plot of combined red and blue dots on the power spectrum was actually very significantly different in a sense of what went into it, because as Francois described, likelihood analysis was performed without any mass phase component separation being performed at all, with very aggressive cuts depending on frequency and different L ranges picked up from different frequency maps, contributing to the input to likelihood and getting parameters. The other part that she was showing in that plot was composed of analysis where all the frequency maps together were analyzed, component separation executed, CMB map computed out of that four different ways, and only then power spectrum estimated on it, on larger area of the sky admitted, and parameters derived, and over very significant L range, except for maybe in excess of 2,000, the results were as consistent as she has shown on the spectrum and parameters, which that's the Planck to Planck that.
Cosmic microarrays, and both are HFI specific things, and precisely, I mean, we have two experiments on board. That's something I wanted to stress again. And there, they are analyzed totally separately. I mean, you have to realize that by different teams using different methods. And this is only at the very end that we actually, you know, get together, check, and see whether there are differences. So we actually have gone quite a bit of already this sort of internal check. So now we are at the next level, which is community check. I mean, we've gone as far as we could go because we essentially agree. So now, yes, we are going to the next level. We have now, say, five experiments on the table. Okay, I mean, we have LFI, HFI, and WMAP on the sort of one range of L. And then we have ACT and SPT and, well, essentially HFI on the high L side. We haven't gone through the full because we didn't have the time yet. I think we are just seeing what I want to see more, which is direct map-to-map comparison, so that allows to see whether there is any residual transfer function that we can isolate. I think that the plot that was new to me, where you show that, you know, 143 gigahertz versus ACT seemed to see no sign of any L-dependent transfer function, is something that is, maybe you don't even realize, but this is really powerful. So I was actually wondering whether there is any ACT activity in the same area that we can hope to see very soon. Is any members of the ACT team which could say a few words on that?
As you know, Puget is in Toronto next week, and we want to look at this. But it was done before in the earlier stages, in which the cross-correlation of ACT and Planck was really beautiful, and it gave further evidence that the beams were on the right track. It wasn't accurate enough to use as a beam determination itself, but it was pretty good, and so the agreement was great with ACT. And I anticipate that with the full maps, there's going to be no change because everything agrees, the parameters agree, no issues.
I would like to switch a bit discussion and come back to these asymmetries, to this hemisphere asymmetries. I mean, if that is discovered, this is of course a very basic thing, huh? Because isotropy and homogeneity is a basic feature of lambda CDM. So if you discover that, you falsify lambda CDM. But I know that there are different opinions. For example, Ichiro has presented some arguments about if this asymmetry really real, and I would just like to have the experts more debating that, because if it's real, then it is a real important point, and one cannot say anymore that lambda CDM is alive. The minimal lambda CDM definitely is isotropic and homogeneous, and you need additions to it, whatever you do, if you want to produce this hemisphere asymmetry.
Yeah. Okay. So, in that case.
No. Next panel in an hour and half an hour.
Yeah. There's a theory discussion. But if anyone on the panel feels that they have something to add, by all means, yes.
I'd like to know whether this 2.5% offset, which you showed as 5.5 or 6 sigma or something like that, do we actually? I understand we care in terms of the instruments, right? But does that is that something we actually care about in terms of cosmology? So you were kind of critical of the WMAP team saying, oh, the cosmological parameters of lambda CDM agree. Well, what about all the other cosmological parameters? You know, that one in particular, it seems like, unless you're starting to compare to clusters or structure or something, I don't think we're at the 2% level yet. Do we really care about that parameter at that level?
Well, I mean, exactly. I mean, combining with other experiments is an issue when you go through different scales. So the model as such is really the CLs. So first of all, you were yourself asking, is this really a constant DC or is it something else? The fact that you have a non-understood 5 sigma effect in your data set means that you don't really control your uncertainties yet. So it's an important point to get right, because we don't know what's going on here.
I would just like to object violently at the fact that we don't care about sigma 8. Now, because but even at 2%, because the low redshift results are not yet at 2%, but they are kind of 4 or 5%. So they're getting very close. Now, and this affects neutrino masses, modified gravity, anything you name it. So I think it's a very important parameter to look at.
Yeah, I recall being on working groups that debated the point endlessly of how well we were going to know tau, the optical depth, precisely for this reason, and then started talking about low L4 grounds.
So first of all, it's 1.3 sigma percent on sigma 8, right? Because we're talking about 2.6% on the power. It's 1.3% on the sigma 8, not 2.6, right? So it's I don't think we're there yet, but yeah, we will be soon. But the other thing is, you should at least add the calibration errors to this comparison, right? I mean, we know that WMAP has 0.6% calibration error.
There's a mean marginalization inside the likelihood package.
True, but the error. But I thought the overall error that you compare is less than 0.6%, right?
No, it's 2.5% difference in power. And the calibration uncertainty is 0.2%, so it's 10 sigma relative to that, but beam uncertainty adds to it, that's 0.6%.
Exactly.
And that's still three times as big as that.
Well, it's not 6%, it's not 6 sigma anymore, it's 0.6%.
Right, yeah, so that's something else, right? So we're really worried about 2.5% L by L, but in his case, I guess, well, I guess because beam errors are correlated.
Yeah.
So factor of 3 is that
3 sigma? Right. So if the error is completely correlated to 3 sigma.
So that was just a straight plugging into WMAP likely. So,
yes, but there are correlated.
Sure.
They are in the likelihood.
Well, but then how can it be?
The
numbers you're quoting and the 6 sigma are the
2.6% divided by 5.7 sigma is less than 0.5%.
So beam errors are correlated, but I guess they're not completely entirely constant offset, right? So
there's
explain it, and then the calibration is much smaller.
But calibration offset is much smaller. That's right. It's 0.2%, not 0.6%.
Yeah, and there's a set of eigenmodes of the beam covariance matrix that you guys put in there.
That's right.
So we are fishing for, extra things which haven't been accounted for, and that's what we are looking for. And so there is one possibility that's been discussed, that is prompted by the funny L shape, is there some estimate of Farsi lobe that we're not propagating properly? And that's a question that the experimental teams are all looking at very furiously at the moment. The only thing I can say is on each side, there have been, the teams have been revisiting the issue and didn't see where this can come from. That's the situation. So, as of today.
Actually, Hans Christian, it would be very useful if you could just do the opposite of this. So you stick WMAP best fit power spectrum, stick that into CanSpec, because in Planck analysis, one of the eigenmodes is lead free, right? One of the eigenmodes of the beam error matrix is lead free, which means if you may not see any difference, right? Because the beam error may just account for everything. Maybe that beam best fit error over the beam would be too large to be accounted for by the direct Mohs measurement.
Are you proposing that the Planck beam uncertainties would account for this?
No, what I'm saying is, if I understand it correctly, for WMAP analysis, beam covariance matrix is fixed.
Yeah.
But in the Planck analysis, the beam error is lead free, right? One of the eigenmodes.
Yeah, I think what you are referring to is to fit for that eigenmode.
But in the Planck likelihood code, it is marginalized over it. So I'm curious what kind of number of sigmas you get if you use Planck likelihood instead of WMAP.
We'll try and see what happens.
So I think for the final 50 minutes of the program, I'd like to move on from the discussion of beam marginalization, but I do think particularly for the theory audience here, and for people thinking about how to build the next generation experiments, I think. Hearing this discussion and seeing how these issues are actually played out between experiments and internal to experiments is generic, and I think it's important for us to hear that again. With that said, is there anyone in the audience who would like to start a new thread? Who would like to like the previous thread? Excellent.
Okay, so you start your old.
Okay, implications for cosmology. There are potentially many, but I would like to come back to the most basic one. The most basic one seems to me, can one falsify lambda CDM, and what is the role for Planck in that? Many of us, of course, like to go beyond lambda CDM, but something what we like, theorists, and what nature likes may be different. So the real issue seems to me, is there a real possibility of falsification? And I think I want to come back a little bit to what it really means. First of all, I think lambda CDM, if you define it, it's of course not just a parameter set. It is the hypothesis that you have a cosmological constant, dark matter, the particle physics of the standard model and single field inflation. I think there's always a theoretical background for every parameter set you choose, otherwise your parameter set is not well motivated. So my first point I want to make is that this model has actually not six but eight parameters. The neutrino mass is definitely a free parameter. There is no point why a value 0.04 electron volt is better than 0.1 electron volt. And also the tensor to scalar ratio in inflationary models is just a free parameter. So I think if we want to shoot and perhaps in the long run to falsify lambda CDM, we should from now on really define that as an eight parameter model as it really is. Now, has Planck a real chance of falsifying? That's not so obvious to me. I mean, if you see really this type of asymmetries, that would be a first point where you falsify it. Otherwise, as the data look to me, the role of Planck is perhaps more that you really fix the parameters of the lambda CDM model, and then this will be a basis for other observations and experiments to challenge that and to see if there is some discrepancy, because as long as these parameters are of course not fixed, everything remains a bit in the big uncertainty. So for that I see really a big possible progress of Planck by fixing these data, and future will show, you know, if other measurements of sigma 8 or H naught at the long run will really deviate statistically significantly from that or not. For the moment, it seems not to be the case for me personally, but I mean, this is the basis if we want to have any chance in the long run to falsify lambda CDM.
Does anyone on the panel want to comment?
Well,
well, and I guess one of the parameters is not really a parameter of the model, but it's just our ignorance to calculate the first stars, because tau is not a, it's just a derived parameter we happen not being able to compute, so it's not the same as the other parameters. No?
Okay, well, yeah, well, Matthias, I guess we have a project for you.
So I guess just a comment and response that you said, could Planck falsify lambda CDM? I think it's a bit of a weird question because it's completely dependent on the model of the universe, right? We had lots of hopes that Planck could have falsified lambda CDM and looked for all sorts of deviations and didn't see them. And you could, I think, argue the same for next generation things. We'll go along, produce, you know, finding experiments that could find a result, and if we find it, wonderful.
I have, this is possibly a silly question along the same lines, but you asked Andre before, is there any information in constraining the tilt more, et cetera. So suppose that you did, and the B modes, and excluded M squared, pi squared, chaotic inflation. Then there's a sense in which there are more parameters in the quantum field theory that we use to describe the system. Does that count as an additional parameter?
This is a bit, other people may be able to answer better, but I would say if you decide you need to add extra parameters to define your model, then it does. But until your data require it, yeah. Yeah. I guess in terms of the data, it not necessarily, because we would continue in the NSR plane. Yeah, I think, and other people may. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Can you use the microphone?
Yeah. I mean, I'm just part of my ignorance, but I was wondering how we will do that even. Because usually you establish relationships from these parameters that you can actually measure in this lambda standard model, for instance, NS and R. And you try to establish relationships between them according to a particular model, inflationary model. So if you start increasing this set of parameters, I guess you have to establish these new relationships between right? So you will not increase necessarily the set of parameters. Yeah.
I mean, so
observables. That's what I mean. You know, observables.
In one class of models, you might make it pi to the p with p variable.
Right.
But that's just one choice. That's just one example. Right. So then, an amplitude and another parameter. Yeah. But.
Why do you continue analyzing data? Since Andrei showed us that any NSR combination can be accounted by a zillion different models. So should I rather go to the beach and stop harassing my fellow Planckian? What is your take on this? I'd like to hear some reactions.
I have the microphone, so I'm going to have a take on this. But the great thing is that there may still be a zillion models that are consistent with the data, but there's more zillions that get ruled out. Isn't that great?
But the problem is that this idea that there are models and we're ruling them out is just, it doesn't describe what we are doing. We hang to this because we think if we don't say this, we're not scientists, we go to some other room. But it just doesn't describe what we are doing. And so, I mean, we have to live with the fact that we're just not, that's not the operational, I mean, these models are also toy models, just a joke in some sense.
Okay, we have some rebuttals from
the group. At the workshop in MPA, Matthias came up with new terminology for crazy models. That's now called abracadabra. Abracadabra. Seriously. So, first of all, and we shouldn't all forget that NS less than one now convincingly found at more than five sigma is a great achievement for Planck, and we should all congratulate. We should never forget that. That's in textbook now. Then my take on this is okay. In fact, am I also interested in nailing down the a particular potential of the inflaton? Well, answer we know. So what I would like to do is to check what are the other firm predictions of inflation. And what we heard, you know, I already said this after Aristotle, but let me just reiterate all this because I think this is going to be great. So R, you know, so in terms of number of V-folds, R could be 1 over N or 1 over N squared, or even less. But I think many people would agree with me that the running index is in fact 1 over N squared, and it's very difficult to make it even smaller than that. In fact, if we don't see running index at the level of 1 over N squared, which means only 10 times smaller than current limit, if we don't find it, we probably in a little bit of trouble in terms of standard inflation scenarios.
No,
particularly,
the answer is no. Right? Of course, you can come up with anything. It's just another problem.
Can I just say one thing though? I think one of the things that Andrei said, and I was very pleased with this. In fact, it's a very simple. You can say for sure that very simple inflationary model, you know, is very much there. And I was giving a talk a few days ago, and someone said, "Oh, you're just telling us that Planck is telling us that you're swearing." And I said that one day, and he got completely non-linear and said, "No, of course not." And in fact, it's quite the opposite. It can give, you know, open the window to actual to super non-dull universe, you know, universe. And you can go as you know, to the limit as just considering a very simple inflationary model. So.
Okay. Even then, I guess. Okay. Go ahead. Okay. You have the microphone. You can talk.
I'm going to give the defense of abracadabra just and briefly. I don't believe we know that you can fill the NSR plane. That there's this infinite sequence of set of models, because of what Liam explained, tried to explain very clearly that it's UV sensitive. So there is more work to do theoretically to understand if that's actually true. And particularly in the large field case, the sensitivity is real, and that is one reason to be continue to be interested. One of many reasons. Also, when you make a constraint, a null result can be extremely useful for reasons that were also explained this morning. It can become a precision probe of, you know, other fields, other sectors, in a way that's, again, very new and important. So keep going, in my humble opinion.
But I want to give you more collaborative. People are talking about both Planck terms.
And the perspective of saying a really important upper limit on R, is it worth a billion euro, dollars, whatever currency units you want, I'm practically engaged in terms of trying to write those proposals, and I find it really hard because, I mean, so I, that's, we're help, crying for help here.
I mean, I'm sure everybody knows this argument, but just for the record, there is a threshold there. In contrast to the non-Gaussianity, where you just keep going down and down, there is a threshold. It's the Planck region field. It's extremely informative, whichever way it goes. It's kind of like the LHC going through the electroweak scale. If you can go through this R of 0.01, you're going through a threshold of the Planck field range, and that's important. So.
Let me come to you. I mean, I think the situation is not so bad. I mean, there is a class of models that is singled out, and this is single field inflation, that there is only one field that has a low mass and the other fields have somewhat higher mass. And that is predictive, at least in the sense that it is a two-parameter model. It has NS and L. And it predicts, for example, there are no large non-Gaussianities, there are no asymmetries, and so on. Everything that goes beyond is, you can, of course, afford a lot of things, but it goes beyond a single model. And the tests of single models have always been important in physics. Now, compared the question of tensors, that's of course a bit harder because we know that in principle we can tailor potentials. Definitely, I would agree with Matthias to produce you at least in the range of tensor or of tensor modes and spectral index that is left over. We can, I think, produce essentially every value by tuning, I would guess. We just tailor the potential. Still, I think even then, there is a certain criterion of simplicity. Because if we do not want to have, you know, two wild potentials, we definitely get restrictions, for example, on the running index. So I think H0 is completely right. This is a good test, because, of course, if you just go arbitrary and you throw the wildest potential, you can also produce the wildest numbers. But there is a large class, again, of simple solutions to a physics problem that gives certain predictions. And if they are not falsified, then one is on the right track. That's how I think, how I see things. So it is actually useful to write a new proposal.
Okay, we have time for one more.
Yeah, and I wanted to go after you on two points. Number one, we must have a falsifiability for lambda CDM. What we're in quest of is the subdominant, because the dominant seems to be lambda CDM, adiabatic fluctuations, small tilt. The anomalies would be visually impressive, but a subdominant effect. And there are lots of ways that that can happen. Now, the other point is, and I think that Matthias was making this point, but in a somewhat different way. What is early universe inflation? It is early universe acceleration, which can manifest itself in many, many, many different ways, including composite fields, et cetera. And to suppose that, it's absolutely amazing. Bow down before this, the cleanliness of the Planck results is really remarkable. But Slava Mukhanov claimed he would have given up inflation had it been slightly different. That, in my view, is a bit self-serving, because there is no way I would give up inflation for even fairly radical options, because it is such a generic thing, and we have the following remarkable thing sitting in front of us, because we know that there's acceleration now. Why shouldn't there be in the ultra-early universe? Same issue. We know there's a Higgs now, which therefore means there's some kind of collective or scalar field with its potential. So we know all of these things happen now physically, and you just tune that back a bit, and that just gives you the framework. But the framework is incredibly broad, and I want to go back to a meeting we had in January, it has the remarkable title of POTUS, but not referring to the guy in Washington, but Physics of the Universe Summit, I think it's called. And that means that people who are there are supposed to be erudite and discuss deep matters. And of course, the old sock came out with these deep matters. Eva was there, for example. And that old saw is inflation falsifiable? And essentially, is it an absolutely fundamental theory? But, you know, that's an old way of thinking about inflation. That old, there must be this unique potential, and that's what we're in quest of. In fact, the landscape is, and this was another aspect of what Andre said, has opened up everything in terms of what the class of possibilities are. So it's a really generic thing, and so wherever we lie on R and S will be a experimental discovery and not a theoretical forecast, or there will be so many theoretical forecasts that that you know what probability to assign to them. Anyway, I wanted to address your question.
We'll make time for one more.
I just wanted to put a more theoretical perspective on things, which is, I think you might be able to falsify inflation, but in the context of a theory like string theory, in the following sense. If you demanded that we are today in a vacuum with a cosmological constant as small as it is, then there could be correlated things with that, even in the landscape. And it may be that the approach to that vacuum is not any slow roll kind of direction. This is a logical possibility. We don't know enough about the landscape today, but it might just be that it comes out. So within the context of a theory like string theory, I think inflation might be falsifiable, quote unquote. It might be, but we do live in a very special vacuum with a very small cosmological constant, and we don't know the statistics of such vacuum well enough to know whether it's a statistical question or not. So.
Thank you. So I believe we've run out of time. So let's thank our panelists once again. And then we will reconvene for the next panel. Yeah, at 4:00.